right, and welcome back to the second hour of Reality Remix. That was the band Mate with their song about my friend Ellen and Morning Light. Dave, this is a live show, and we're always encouraging people to call in. So do you want to read the numbers so people know what to dial?
Yes, in the UK, 0113-815-0068. In the US, 954-903-0748. And if you want to come on Skype, add ATS Live Studio to your program, and we will bring you in.
All right. To close out the last hour, we had two highly speculative topics that didn't really have any basis upon which to hang one's hat. We're going to spend this second hour with someone who deals with the realm of irrationality on a frequent basis. And when all is said and done, hopefully we'll have some tips and pointers in dealing with outlandish claims that fly in the face of logic, evidence, and in some cases, sanity. Dave, let's get started on the subject of scientific debunking.
All right, thanks, Dale. If there is one thing that I enjoy about conspiracy theories and alternative views, it is the opportunity to use our imaginations and to speculate on a variety of topics. It's fun to talk about, for example, secret societies that may control the governments of the world, or alien visitations, and perhaps NASA lied to us, and we never went to the moon. While those conversations can be fun and exciting, our romanticism with the esoteric can sometimes lead us to forget about common sense, logic, and cold hard facts. Our guest for the next hour is a PhD physicist that uses his expertise, education, and facts to combat the spread of bad science and disinformation as it applies to the conspiracy realm. Before we dig in too deep, Stuart, I'd like to ask why you decided to take your education and expertise and apply it to the skeptical side of conspiracies.
I think the primary reason is that I find it interesting. And I also find that I generally kind of like to argue with some people. And I would listen to people saying various things about, I don't know, how there's a face on Mars, for example, or we never went to the moon, and I would find myself yelling at the audio file. So I decided to do something a little bit more constructive, and I started a blog so I could write down my rants, and then a few years later I started a podcast so people could actually hear me rant. Although I should say, for anyone who hasn't listened to the podcast, that in general, I don't rant. I try to be actually very, very measured in the analysis and to just really go through what the claims are, what the claimed evidence is, and then examine that evidence if it's even valid, and then look at what the real science say. And I find that my background, my education has given me sort of given me a unique perspective and a unique skill set that a lot of people don't have. I mean, a lot of people aren't trained in how to process spacecraft imagery. A lot of people aren't trained in how to analyze geologic features from spacecraft imagery. And so I find that I'm sort of better equipped to handle a lot of these different things that are put out there. And I try to share that because I think that it's also sort of it's almost a requirement, in my opinion, that scientists share what they know. I mean, that's the entire point. You can be the best scientist in the world, but if you never talk to anyone about your discoveries or about what you do, then who cares? No one's going to know.
Absolutely. Great point. Now, I'd like to ask, was there one particular claim or theory right off the bat when you first started looking into this that really got your goat, that really pushed you to do what you do now with the blogs and the podcast?
Not really in that sense. I mean, there was one that I got started with, and that was the Apollo moon hoax, because I mean that one's been beaten to death for 40 years, and yet for some reason people still believe it. And I sort of got my start on that with a class project where we had to give a seminar, and it was on the moon that semester, and I asked if one of the topics could be the Apollo moon hoax, so we could sort of go through the various claims and see what the actual science is. And that turned into a planetarium show, and that turned into a talk that I gave to the public, and then it's just sort of went on from there. And I think I really hit my stride in general with the 2012 stuff and the few years leading up to that with Planet X and Pole Shifts and that stuff. And even though, obviously, we all survived 2012, or at least the people who lived past it, nothing drastic happened to the planet, people are still claiming that there's going to be a pole shift, or there's Planet X out there, or there's going to be a solar kill shot, or all this other stuff. And so everything that I addressed, even though it had a deadline of December 21st, 2012, people are still using those same arguments for whatever they decide the next doomsday is.
Absolutely. All right, we are going to actually touch on some of those topics you just addressed. But throughout the show, we're going to allow people in the studio and callers, if we get some callers, to jump in and ask you their questions. And I think Mel has one to start us off. Go ahead, Mel.
Yes, I do. Now, I have no problem. I think we went to the moon, just to put that out there. Yes, we went to the moon, and I believe it. I hold no credence to that part of, you know, that hoaxing, or that they hoax the moon landing. My question is seeing how we are as a society, I mean, we go looking in the deep, deep ocean to extract resources, you know, and we're digging up all of our planet, you know, to, you know, further advance our technology. My question is why aren't we exploiting the moon? Why didn't we go back? Why aren't there moon bases? And my theory is whatever's out there told us not to come back.
Well, I think that it's much more down-to-earth based, because you have to have a political will to spend the hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars in order to do this. And there was a large political opposition even during the Apollo era. And after we went to the moon six times successfully, the political will just crumbled. We'd done it. We'd beaten the Russians. And even today, there are a lot of scientists and actually a lot of investors who want to go back to the moon. The scientists want to do science, but you know, the investors want to do exactly as you said. They want to start to try to extract material from the moon. I think it's Harrison Schmidt, the one geologist who went to the moon, one of the Apollo astronauts. He's been going on for many years about how the moon is rich in helium-3, which could be used for energy generation on Earth. Meanwhile, you know, as you said, we're exploring the deep oceans and various other places. That's hard to do, but it's still so much cheaper than getting to the moon. I mean, I think, and I know I'm going to be wrong on this, but roughly speaking, the number to launch something like a pound of material into space is $1,000. And it's a huge amount of money. And beyond the launch cost, just in fuel, you have to have all of the infrastructure in place. You have to have all of the engineers doing this. You have to have spacecraft built and all this other stuff. So to me, the much more mundane, there just isn't a political will and money to do it, is all you need in order to explain why we haven't been back.
All right, I have if I could just get in one question on chat, ATS chat, Wanamedia asks, you know, why are we bombing the moon? You know, if there's nothing up there that we're not afraid of, because I really think we were told to stay away. You know, I've listened to all of the astronomers say, hey, we see Santa Claus, you know, and all of the little codes and stuff, and I'm convinced we're not alone. But why were we bombing the moon? I know they said it was for water, but I mean, they can tell now with exoplanets light years away whether or not that body probably has water or not. So what were we bombing the moon for?
We are actually talking about two very different types of observations. I mean, with exoplanets, the only way at the moment that we have to tell whether or not there's water is to look at the light that's filtered from the star through the exoplanet's atmosphere. So we can look at the spectrum. We can spread out the light into all of its various colors and wavelengths and look for that signature of water. On the moon, we don't have that. We don't have any ability to really do that. And so what NASA did was they had the LCROSS mission, or as some people called it, the LaCrosse mission, and they didn't bomb the moon. It depends on what your definition of bomb is. To me, they smashed an object into it in order to look at the material that was ejected and then did the exact same thing that we do with exoplanets to figure out what they're made out of, or at least their atmosphere is made out of. They did the same thing. They looked at that plume that was ejected out to see if there was that signature of water. So it's the same kind of observation, but you can't make it on the moon because there's no atmosphere unless you sort of make one. And so that's why we knocked a projectile in order to send up that plume of material that we could then look at.
Okay.
As opposed to there being a Nazi base there that we were taking out.
Right. And there are some people who believe that there was a secret space program base. I mean, you mentioned people in the first hour. Richard Hoagland, for example, I don't remember what he called it on his website. I think the Smoking Gun Part 1 and 2, where he claimed that there was this base. And what he did was he looked at this image that NASA had put out of the plume from the impact. And he basically read into the image compression noise, and he enhanced it and stretched it and brought it out. And you can tell that that's what happened if you're at all familiar with these kinds of artifacts. I try not to use the word artifact because people think that means intelligent thing that's on the surface. It's a type of image anomaly. I mean, you ever compress something into a small JPEG file and you get it on the other end of an email and you're like, I can't tell what's going on. It looks all blocky. That's the type of image that Richard used. And then he did his enhancement process that just brings out that kind of noise. And then he said, hey, look at all these rectangular, rectilinear kinds of features. That's infrastructure. That's this secret space program base. No, the reason that it's rectangular and rectilinear and this other stuff is because that's what that kind of image noise looks like, and it's very common. But that's sort of one of the things that is Richard Hoagland's MO. I mean, or not MO, that's his... Yeah, it's one of the things that he tends to do with image processing in order to bring out his anomalies, is he reads into this noise and he enhances it, and that's what happened there.
Okay, I think that... our friend Beezer has a question, and we'll let him jump in.
Yes, I do. Thanks. You're a very pragmatic person, and ever since I found out you were going to be a guest on our show, I had a question. Now, it's you bring common sense to the fore on a lot of these issues, but I have to ask, and the one thing I wanted to ask, is in the spectrum of conspiracy theories, is there anything that you, with your background, you can say, okay, you can debunk the Starbucks and the Nazi base on Mars or the moon or whatever, but is there anything you could say, well, yeah, that's plausible, you know, this UFO, this, you know, say the face on Mars, let's bring that up. You know, is there anything that you would say, yes, that's definitely positive in the sphere of conspiracy?
It's hard to answer that. And I say that knowing that it sounds like I'm trying to weasel out of answering it. But in the various conspiracies that I've looked into, and those include, you know, pretty much everything that I mentioned before, I really haven't found anything that is plausible given what we know now. I mean, there is, you know, sort of one major conspiracy that I almost never address, and that's UFOs. That's the UFOs equal aliens. And I try to make that distinction because UFO literally just means unidentified flying object. And I mean, I see UFOs all the time. That doesn't mean I jump to aliens. But the reason that I tend not to address that very much is because the vast majority of the evidence that people point to for UFOs is the eyewitness testimony. And it's just that's not really within the realm of what I study. It's not really in the realm of astronomy, geology, physics, any of that stuff. That's more human psychology. And I think that to a lot of people, eyewitness testimony is very trustworthy. But to me, and I think to a lot of the people in the broader skeptical or scientific skepticism community, eyewitness testimony isn't that reliable. And, I mean, I can point to, for example, I've heard people say, well, that UFO equal alien, put that in parentheses, that UFO was reported by a police officer or a pilot. They are trained observers, completely trustworthy. I would generally agree with you that police officers, airline pilots are generally trustworthy. But that doesn't mean that the human brain that everyone that we know of, that is human, has, isn't at play here. And human perception is very tricky. And, I mean, I'll relate a UFO example of my own. I was in Australia vacationing for 40 days or so, and I saw a UFO over the beach. I had no idea what it was. I just saw lights sort of twirling around and doing acrobatic feats that, as people say, this couldn't possibly be any sort of terrestrial aircraft. No idea what it was. I wasn't about to jump to aliens. And then it passed in front of a tree that was about 40 feet away from me. And I knew exactly what it was. It was a quadcopter, this sort of little remote control thing with four blades. It's not a helicopter. It's called a quadcopter. And it had lights on the bottom. And that's what it was. And yet, I'm an astronomer, or a geophysicist, or whatever you want to call me, and I'm a trained observer. I've looked at this stuff for years. I've stared through telescopes. And yet, I had no idea what it was. And if I had been any more inclined to believe that aliens are visiting us in craft with lights on the bottom, I would have probably immediately jumped to, that's an alien craft. But instead, I was able to watch it for a little bit longer, and it happened to pass in front of a tree, and I knew exactly what it was. But that's hard to say in every case. You have to take every case on an individual basis, and that's sort of really why I don't get into the UFO conspiracy stuff as much as an incredibly long-winded answer to your question.
Okay, just as a follow-up, a quick follow-up, then is any observation? I mean, we're solely relying on anecdotal evidence. Then is any observation truly valid?
That's a difficult question to answer. In general, I would say that any individual observation by a single person or even a group of people that's reporting something, unless it's independently verifiable and preferably with actual documentation, and I completely recognize that these days even video or photos are very easily doctored, but at that point you can start to examine that actual evidence. But when you just have someone reporting something, it's possibly a start. It might be an interesting start. But that's all it is. It's a start to a phenomenon that you then have to investigate and try to get more objective, concrete data in order to back it up. You can't just go on that eyewitness testimony. And I say that being a huge fan of Law and Order.
Okay. As a scientist, do you believe we're alone in the universe?
Well, so that would get into my own personal opinion, I guess.
Your own personal opinion.
My own personal opinion would be probably not. I just don't think that we have gotten any good concrete evidence yet to back up my opinion. But I think that the universe is vast enough that there's, in my opinion, a very small likelihood that we are the only form of life.
That's very interesting.
Well, thank you very much for answering my question, sir.
I tried to do it sort of very carefully.
You did it great.
Well, those are some great questions, and I have to give you credit. It takes a lot to get us off track here at Reality Remix, and we're way off the rails. It's some great questions and very insightful. But I do want to touch on a few specifics and open up the conversation a little bit broader. And I want to talk about the Apollo moon pics. One of the claims of people who don't believe that we have been to the moon is that the pictures were altered. And one of the things they point to is the stars. NASA blackened out everything above the horizon, and you cannot see stars. Therefore, we did not go to the moon. Somebody, an astronomer and a semi-pro photographer, how would you go about addressing that?
So this is actually one of the most common claims out there as to why we didn't go to the moon. And It's actually, this is one of those cases that I really like because it's easy to do your own experiment to show why this claim is not valid debunking of the moon hoax, why this claim is not a valid debunking of the landings. So the answer, the quick answer is dynamic range for anyone who knows that term. The longer answer, and I'll do this by way of an example, take a camera, pretty much any camera, as long as you can have manual exposure settings. Go outside when there is a moonlit night and adjust the exposure setting until you get a good exposure of the moon. And if you do that, if you're running on ISO about 100 with an aperture of about f6-ish, you're probably looking at an exposure for the moon of about 1/60th of a second or so. And play with those settings. So that's, you have now exposed the moon for when it is daytime on the moon. Now, go to any dark area of the sky, use those exact same settings, and take a picture. You will not see any stars. You have to adjust the camera, the exposure setting, the shutter speed, to something like 30 seconds or longer in order to get any pictures of the stars. And that was what was going on the moon. I mean, the astronauts set the cameras to expose for daytime on the moon. That's why they didn't get any stars. The stars are simply too faint relative to the moon's surface in order to capture them in the same shot. With that said, the astronauts on later missions actually did take pictures of stars. In that case, they had an ultraviolet camera, or a camera that had ultraviolet film, and they took pictures of various spots in the sky with that ultraviolet film, and they brought them back to Earth and developed them. And you can see them today on any number of archival websites. And this was actually, it's one of those independent pieces of evidence that shows that we did go to the moon, because we were not able to do ultraviolet astronomy before we went above Earth's atmosphere, because the Earth's atmosphere screens out ultraviolet light. So it was really the Apollo mission where we got the astronauts to take these pictures, and we see these pictures of these ultraviolet sources that we didn't know about. We can then do ultraviolet astronomy today with satellites, with ultraviolet cameras and sensors, and we can compare, we can sort of run the clock backwards and see, okay, where were the astronauts pointed, what time of year, look at what the sky looked like with the ultraviolet sources that we know of now from satellites that we have in orbit, and see if those sources are the same. And they are. That would have been impossible to fake at the time because we didn't know about these ultraviolet light sources in the sky, because we simply couldn't take those pictures until the Apollo astronauts actually went up to the moon and above the Earth's atmosphere and were able to do this. So again, I think that's a very long-winded way of answering your question.
So we do have pictures of the stars from the moon.
We do have pictures of stars taken with the ultraviolet cameras, and I think there are maybe one or two photos, normal pictures of the Apollo, from Apollo, where some of the very brightest stars in the sky, like Sirius, are actually very, very faintly visible. But really, I mean, the claim comes about because people think the sky is black, therefore it's night, therefore there should be stars. That's not the case. The sky is black because it was simply set for daylight exposure, and you don't have an atmosphere on the moon to scatter light around to make it blue.
Very nice. All right, well, let's go from no stars to another one. No good conspiracy would be complete if we didn't talk about Nazis. There is a theory that Wernher von Braun, the brains behind the Saturn V rocket program that put us on the moon, he was also the head of Nazi Germany's V2 program, took a trip to Antarctica and brought back rock samples that would later be passed off as the lunar samples collected by astronauts. The lunar samples are fake, and therefore we didn't go to the moon. In your expert opinion, is there a way to debunk that?
Yes. And there are actually two claims there. The first is that he went to Antarctica and collected these rocks and presented them as moon rocks. And the second is that the rocks supposedly brought back by Apollo are not from the moon. So the first one, Earth has an atmosphere. When a rock from space comes through the atmosphere, the outer part of it melts and it forms what's called a fusion crust. It's this sort of black glassy thing that if you ever go to a museum that has a meteorite and you look at sort of the outer part of it, it'll be this nice black, smooth, glassy type surface. It's smooth, therefore, because of it's melted, therefore it has no teeny tiny craters in it. If you have a rock that is has not gone through Earth's atmosphere or has been protected from Earth's atmosphere, it has been bombarded by little teeny tiny micrometeorites the size of a grain of sand, and those form teeny tiny craters called zap pits, ZAPPITS. All of the Apollo samples have zap pits. None of the meteorites have zap pits. So right there, we know that these rocks from the Apollo missions that all have these zap pits on them came from at least not Earth through Earth's atmosphere unless they were protected in some way like in an Apollo capsule. And actually, I think that that debunks both of them at the same time. Another way to look at it is simply that we have gotten some meteorites from Antarctica that are from the moon, and the total mass of them is something like 1% of the entire mass brought back by the Apollo mission. So it's kind of like you have something like a ton or half a ton, I forget the exact number, of rocks back brought back from the moon by Apollo, whereas we have something like a few pounds of moon rocks brought back from Antarctica. So there's sort of a mass problem just because it's much more likely we're going to get asteroids raining down on Earth than chunks blasted off of the moon that happen to also rain down on Earth. So there are sort of two ways to look at that. But for me, the little micrometeorite impacts are the best way.
Very good. All right, we're going to open this back up to the studio, and I believe Charles has a question.
Well, I do. Actually, I've got a couple. But first, it's a real honor to have you here. It's just delightful, and I'm glad you made the trip. I'd like to switch away from actual physical objects and conspiracies to more of a philosophy of science. And I got the idea of a little bit of yours by looking at some of your podcasts. I didn't listen to all of them, I have to admit. I just picked ones that looked interesting to me because I have no science whatever.
That's okay.
One of the things that you wrote was what peer review typically is good at is weeding out particularly bad research and ideas that don't have solid evidence to back them up. That's one reason why pseudoscientists in particular tend to strongly dislike the process. They simply can't pass it. Their ideas are so tenuous, do not have enough good evidence to support them, cannot adequately address criticisms, and or obvious observations did not find it or found the opposite, that they aren't accepted. You may have run across the John Bohannon study that was just published fairly recently in Science magazine. Mr. Bohannon had an idea. He created a completely bogus study, presented it under the names of fictitious people coming from fictitious universities and institutions, said that it was clear to anybody who knew any science that the thing was bogus. He sent out about 300 of these things. The Science magazine article says, by the time Science went to press, 157 of the journals had accepted the paper, and 98 had rejected it. Acceptance took about 40 days, 24 days for a rejection. Then there was another study in which they analyzed the papers that had been retracted from journals. And the reason given for those retractions was that there had been computational errors made. Again, from that article, when looked at more closely, it turns out that 3/4 of the retracted papers were fraudulent. Researchers engaged in active falsification of data, not computational mistakes. I'm wondering then, is it really safe to put our trust in peer-reviewed articles as the last word?
To answer your question, the short version is no. But peer review is the best system that we have, and it does have its flaws. But you should keep in mind that a lot of the journals that he submitted to aren't really that rigorous. For example, so I'm a planetary scientist. In general, there may be half a dozen journals that I would ever consider submitting to. There are other journals that I could submit to, but I won't because they're so small and so marginal that no one is going to read them. In all of the journals that I submit to, it goes through an editor, an associate editor, and then anywhere from one to three or more reviewers, possibly multiple times. And so I can only speak from my experience that the peer review process in terms of the gibberish papers tends to only happen in those cases where there really isn't this multi-level process. It's sort of those journals that say they're peer-reviewed that act like it in order to try to sell something, because almost all journals charge people to read their papers. As for the retractions, you have to look at numbers. The retractions are on the order of, I think you said a few dozen or a few hundred?
Retractions were 2,000.
Okay, 2,000.
They looked at. And 1,500 roughly were retracted, and it turned out they were fraudulent and not just errors.
And was that per year or over the course of many, many years? Because
you know,
you've
got me on that one. I don't have an answer. Maybe it's over the last 5,000 years. I don't know.
I mean, the number that I've heard was that it's somewhere around in the hundreds per year. Contrast that with tens of thousands of papers actually published in the peer-reviewed literature per year. Now, so I just reviewed a paper today, so this sort of is fresh in my mind. When we peer-review a paper, we tend to assume that there is not outright fraud. And at least in my field, in planetary geology or geophysics, or again, sort of whatever you want to call it, I study craters mostly, there really isn't fraud. I mean, it would be hard to do it, and it would be sort of pointless because we all use each other's data, and the first person to get that paper and try to use the data would say, hey, this is bogus, there's nothing here. In the medical literature, I think it's probably a little easier to get that through, but then that gets to the whole process of science, and that's that replication is needed. You know, the first person to actually write about something is probably going to get most of the credit, but the most important part is to get it out there so that then other people will actually replicate it. And if there's fraud, or if it's a gibberish paper and it somehow got through the peer review process, as soon as people start to try to replicate it, they're not going to get those results. And so they start to go, what's going on here? And they check what they're doing and check it again. And then they publish saying, hey, we're not getting the same thing. And another lab is going to say, hey, we're not getting the same thing. And then another lab. And so even if it's in the peer-reviewed literature, if it's outright fraud, usually it becomes fairly quickly marginalized. And there are famous examples of this. And sometimes it does take a while. But then when you have overwhelming consensus replicated innumerable times that something is real, then you sort of have to take that for what that is worth. I mean, for example, relativity. Einstein's relativity was just a hypothesis until it was tested and tested and tested many, 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 many times, and it's still being tested today. Every single time, the predictions of relativity have held up. And so that's why we call it a theory. It's because it's pretty much withstood every single attempt to knock it down. Every single scientific experiment that's been done has verified its predictions. Contrast that with one of these other papers that has been retracted because of fraud. I mean, then you get into the case where when you try to replicate it, it doesn't pan out.
That's all very encouraging, and I'm glad to hear it. Thank you for telling me about that. There was one other comment in that article that pointed to something that disturbed me as well. And as you say, this is in biomedical and life sciences where it's a little easier to get the slippery, vague kind of paper through. It says, one of the authors of the study of fraud in the biomedical and life sciences research, Arturo Casa de Vale of Albert Einstein College of Medicine says that the increase in fraudulent papers is due to winner-take-all atmosphere in the field. He notes that getting a paper published in a major journal is the difference between heading a lab and heading for the door. Is that a problem?
It is very cutthroat, and people look at your publication record, but I cannot speak for everyone, and I cannot even really speak for ever being on a hiring committee. I mean, I'm fairly young in my career, but at least at the university where I work, in the specific lab that I work, and lab being 200 people, not like my own little research group, but the institute within the university where I work, when I was up for promotion, they looked at my CV, at all the papers that I had published, and they actually solicited feedback from people in the field to ask, hey, is he doing reasonable work? Is it good? Is it, you know, what it should be? Is he good in the field? And if I were up for promotion to a larger position, then they actually start to ask other people. They contact experts, world-renowned experts in the field, and ask them about my work. And so in that sense, your publication record, it's important, but it's only what you see on paper. But there is that whole publish or perish attitude. And if you don't get papers out, then you're not probably going to get that better job or that great position heading a lab. And I think that might be especially, again, in the case of more, even more cutthroat fields in planetary science, like the medical field, where you really, really have to be writing papers. And it's unfortunate that that's what academia has become, but that's sort of what it's like these days, for better or for worse. Yeah.
I can't tell you how grateful I am. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well,
Mel, jump in there, Mel.
Yeah, I want to take you back into, you know, la-la land a little bit. I have a question from somebody on our ATS chat who's listening in, and it's Blue Moon 2. And she would like to know if you're familiar with Jacques Vallée?
I know the name. Is that the guy who the Frenchman character was based off of in Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm remotely aware of his stuff.
Yeah, she just wanted to know what you thought of his stance on UFOlogy, because earlier you had mentioned you think it's more psychological, you know, and Jacques Vallée, he believes that, you know, all of these UFOs has to do with our consciousness, and as when we do something that upsets the control system, the larger grid we don't understand and can't see, that's when you'll see a UFO. It's the control system making a correction or whatnot. And
Well, again, so sort of my own personal opinion, I think that how you described this when you started getting into the la-la land is how I would describe that. There's sort of a new age idea of this ethereal consciousness cloud, you know, very Deepak Chopra-esque kind of thing. The problem is that, you know, there's no good, solid, concrete evidence for it. And I should state at this point, you know, because we're towards the end, that I would love for all of that kind of thing to be true. I would love for there to be this overarching consciousness field and there to be various manifestations of it doing this thing or these things. The problem is, I just don't think that there is good evidence for it. Similarly, when you start to get into that with Jacques Vallée's idea that the UFOs are more consciousness manifestation kind of thing, that falls into the same category for me. What I meant when I said that I think that UFOs are more psychological and more human perception, it gets back to the, I don't know what that object is, I can't tell how far away it is, I'm going to estimate it, or I'm going to estimate how big I think it is, therefore it's traveling this fast. That is sort of what I meant in terms of the human perception, as opposed to manifestations of a greater consciousness.
Okay. All right. And I have one question. And it takes us to the Black Knight object. Being an astronomer, and you've had your eyes to the sky, to the universe, what do you think that is?
I am only vaguely familiar with that. I think I've heard a little bit about it, but I really can't comment on it without actually having done any research on it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
If you have me back on, I can prepare. We can bring it up again.
Dale, please speak up.
Yeah, I have a question / comment about these sorts of claims in general. You kind of came across our radar. Dave and I were talking on a different show about a book that he had called The Ringmakers of Saturn. And after that show, I went and did some research on that and found your blog and sent it along to Dave. And one of the things that sort of occurs to me as I, you know, think about The Ringmakers of Saturn, which, of course, was the claim by someone, I think in the 70s, that the rings of Saturn were actually being manufactured by giant spacecraft. And you look at Richard Hoagland with the Cydonia stuff, the face on Mars, the pyramids on Mars, his ziggurat that you so effectively debunked with your video a few weeks ago. A lot of this stuff, one thing that sort of strikes me is the grand nature of it, that these are all huge things that are supposedly going on. And I wonder if you have an opinion as to how much of that sort of filters down from, you know, people that read something like Niven's Ring World and think about, you know, how cool it would be to have, you know, that sort of stuff going on actively around us. And if we, you know, look, we can dismiss the sort of mundane claims of, well, you know, these things look like pyramids because of the winds of Mars. And no, they were obviously pyramids made by somebody, you know, who thought it important enough to build this gigantic structure on Mars.
So I'm not entirely sure what you're asking. You're asking why sort of there are these sort of bigger picture kinds of ideas out there as opposed to maybe something more mundane and boring?
Well, just if you see, you know, a connection between, you know, people wanting the universe to be something more than it is, and so then they look in or, you know, they see into something and they see, you know, okay, well, here's rings. Well, you know, it's not a moon that was, you know, destroyed that, you know, coalesced into these rings. There's got to be spaceships there or they're building it. You know, it doesn't seem like the claims that are made are these minor things. It's always some just big, huge, complicated, complex thing that is, you know, seems like more science fiction than actual fact or potential fact.
Well, I think that it gets to sort of what people want to believe. I mean, it's much more interesting to think that there is a giant, and by giant, I mean like bigger than a city kind of space alien making the rings of Saturn, or that there's a 2-mile-wide pyramid and giant face on Mars rather than, oh, there might be a tiny microbe locked away in the ice 3 kilometers down in the surface of Mars. I just think that that's sort of more interesting. I think that there are probably people out there who have the more mundane ideas, but you don't get well-known for that. You get well-known for making more outlandish kinds of claims and more big picture kind of stuff. I mean, that's sort of maybe what's almost interesting and you have to admire about someone like Richard Hoagland, is that he has created such a broad, all-encompassing idea of what's going on. Now, granted, it has so many internal conflicts that it's not really worth going into, but he at least has this giant big picture, and I think that that might be why his ideas have caught on. As for actual physical size, which isn't what you asked, but I think something that is worth addressing a little bit, the whole reason that Berggren has, and he's the guy who wrote the Ringmakers of Saturn book from 1986, that why he has these giant spaceships and why Hoagland has these giant faces and pyramids and other things is because that's the size of the imagery that we have. I mean, you sort of are limited to what the actual pictures are. And early on in the exploration of Mars, we had images where the only thing that you could really see object-wise was this stuff that was a mile across or bigger. With the rings of Saturn, well, when Pioneer and Voyager went by, the stuff that you could see was the scale of several tens of kilometers long. And so that's what you see. And so I think that that says a little bit also about what's going on psychologically, that you sort of see what you want to see, and you're, even the limitations of the images feed into that. Does that sort of answer what you were going for?
Yeah. Yeah. I think okay. that addresses it well. And, you know, I think also the bigger something is, the easier it is to sort of debunk, right? That, you know, if somebody says there's microbes on Mars, well, that's not really easy to dispute. But when you've got something like a 2-mile pyramid, it's probably easier for you to look at and say, okay, well, here's what's really going on.
Yeah, well, and especially these days that we have higher resolution imagery. I mean, we can go to that mesa that people say is a face and look at it instead of where it's maybe 50 pixels across. We can look at it with images that are thousands of pixels across and see intricate details that we couldn't see before, and it's just an eroded hill. I mean, that's what it is. And it's the same thing with the pyramids. I mean, I just put out a podcast episode on the pyramids of Mars. It's the same thing. In the Viking imagery, with the lower resolution, with the higher contrast, it looks like these smooth sides, nice and regular. You look at it these days with images that are just meters per pixel as opposed to tens or hundreds of meters per pixel, and it doesn't look like it. It's not a perfect pyramid. It looks like a star dune on Earth, which is this neat kind of sand dune that forms five or six or more or less sides, just formed by complex wind patterns. So I think that the grand conspiracies ideas are neat. I mean, I loved the Stargate franchise. I would watch it. I would watch like 10 episodes at once. And I loved this idea of this giant military complex with visiting alien worlds and all this cool stuff. But that's science fiction. And, you know, you can say, well, you know, we don't have evidence because they've hidden all the evidence. Well, at that point, that's all you can say. You can't address it anymore, at least from a skeptical standpoint. You can no longer debunk it or try to debunk it because any evidence for it is evidence against it. It's just sort of in this endless loop now.
All right. Thanks. Dave, go ahead and...
Yes, you had mentioned the lunar ziggurat that was put out there by Richard Hoagland. And I'm a gamer. I like to play games. I used to be really big into Call of Duty Zombies. And there was a rumor going around the internet that the image that Hoagland put out there of this 1-mile step pyramid actually originated from a hoax put on the Call of Duty Zombies forum. And you've looked at this image. Can you actually comment on that? Is that true?
I'll try to be brief with that one. Mike Barra was the one who gave it to Richard Hoagland. Mike Barra says that he got that version of the image from the Call of Duty Zombies forum. He says that he saw it many, many years earlier. A lot of people say that it was actually created by a guy going by the name of KK Samurai, who did a lot of these sort of hoaxed images in the 1990s. That person actually claims that it's real. But the version that is out there now is definitely, at least for the last decade or so, you can quote-unquote originated from the Call of Duty Zombies forum.
Okay, that's all I needed to hear. Mel, jump in there.
Oh, I had a question from Doma1, and he wanted to know if there are mirrors on the moon that you can shoot lasers to and get it to bounce back.
Yes. I could go. Do you want me to go a little bit further?
Yeah.
So the Apollo program, the Apollo astronauts deployed what are called retro reflectors, which is this neat kind of mirror that will reflect light back in the exact direction from whence it came. And the point of this was so that we could shine a laser at these retro reflectors from Earth onto the moon and then back and record the signal and measure exactly how long it took the light to return, and so we could exactly measure its distance. And from those measurements over the last 45 years or so, we've been able to measure that the moon is actually moving away from Earth at something like roughly an inch a year. So, yeah, if you shine a laser at the moon in any given location, it's not going to be, you're going to get barely any photons back. But if you shine it at these Apollo landing sites, you're going to get a much stronger signal back, and that's because of these mirrors. So that's actually another independent way of showing that we did go to the moon, or at least something did to deploy these.
All right, Dale, looks like we're low on time.
Yeah, thank I tried to talk quickly.
Thanks for coming on. We'll have a chance to talk after this, but Dale, we'll let you do your thing.
All right, that wraps up this live episode of Reality Remix. Thank you for listening, and be sure to stop by the show thread in the ATS Live forum to check out the show links and leave us some feedback. Or check out our website at realityremixshow.com. Thank you again to Dr. Stuart Robbins for joining us. And be sure to check out his show at podcast.sjrdesign.net. The most recent episode is a detailed debunking of the theory of artificial pyramids on Mars. Tomorrow night at 8 p.m., ATS Radio brings you Bushcraft on Fire, the survivalist show with Garth Holt and friends. You can hear After Midnight at 9 p.m. Friday night, The Mothership ATS Live Saturday at 9, and Sundays feature ATS Live Euro at 2 p.m. The show for Monday night is Out of the Box at 10 p.m., and things start up again next Wednesday with The Bare Truth at 8 p.m. All times Eastern, adjust accordingly. You have just been present for ATS Live's Reality Remix, a different path through existence. We now return you to normal space. Until next time.